How's it, everyone? This is Nate. I get to welcome you to the show and tell you about our sponsor for today's podcast. Our sponsor today is Oakley Standard Issue, which is a division of Oakley for serving those that serve government, military, law enforcement, firefighters, and EMS, the whole lot. Qualified members get exclusive access to new products, service-related discounts, that's the big one, but still a whole lot more. Products they're already known for are their eyewear. Ballistic rated and industrial certified, it's perfect for on the job. Footwear that meets uniform regulations while on duty. Some of my favorite boots I've ever had, I picked up when I was in Fort Bliss, Texas, and did lots of ruck marches there. Awesome, awesome boots. Accessories like gloves, my favorite gloves have been Oakley gloves, backpacks as well. They've also got some new released off-duty styles and collections that are worth heading on over to check out. So to do that, head to oakleysi.com where you can register and then take advantage of our discount code, which is fieldcraft15 at checkout. That way you can receive an additional 15% off your first order. Again, that's oakleysi, Sierra India, for all you professionals, .com. And head on over to check that out and claim this discount. How's it, everyone? Nate here with the show's sponsor for today. This episode is proudly sponsored by the U.S. Concealed Carry Association, a leader in responsible gun ownership and survival training. Fellow survival enthusiasts, we all know the key question in our minds. Are you truly prepared for whatever life throws at you? Are you as physically prepared as possible to shoot with precision under pressure? Are you mentally ready to deal with the adrenaline and extreme stress? Do you have a lawyer on retainer in case you need to defend you in court after using your gun in self-defense? If you answer no to any of those, it's okay, but it doesn't mean it will be okay. You need to be as prepared as possible to survive a gun owner in today's world. That means being ready for a mental, physical, and legal action of self-defense. That's why I've been a member for 3 years, because the USCCA, I have all the tools necessary to become a better equipped shooter and protector. Head to the uscca.com/FCS to start your membership risk-free today and get instant access to all the resources you need, as well as a free survival gift. Thanks, uscca.com/FCS.
Just want to give a quick shout out to the Sig Sauer Academy and Sig Sauer. They're one of our sponsors here at the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. And Sig is one of those awesome companies that I've really enjoyed working with over the years. Even before I joined the ranks of the Fieldcraft Survival crew, I was going up to the Sig Sauer Academy back in 2015 and training up there. Guys, if you can't train with us at one of our locations, go up to New Hampshire, go meet the folks from the Sig Sauer Academy and train with them up there. There's a lot to do in the live free or die state. And I'll tell you, you can make a weekend out of it. So you show up the night before, you do your thing, go out to dinner, take the wife or the husband, whatever you got. And the next morning, go out, get a good breakfast, train, go to the experience center, get a good meal at Goody Cole's, go stay at the Exeter Inn, great place, and just really just enjoy that area. New Hampshire is one of the greatest states to train in, super friendly people, and I think you're really going to enjoy training at the Sig Academy. I've been there probably 24 times in my lifetime, and I've done everything from the pistol classes to the carbine classes, the defensive shotgun courses, and the precision rifle courses. Probably the most fun you're going to have there is bullets on vehicles, where you do a lot of ballistic training through glass and into vehicles. And probably one of the most important classes you will ever take is the 3-day precision rifle class, because it will make you a better shooter across every platform. Not to mention you get a chance to shoot out to 1,000 yards. Sig is really, really raising the bar, you can say that. With the Experience Center. I mean, they've got a museum there. They have an indoor shooting range. The Pro Shop is a place where you can spend a lot of money. So just be real careful. And while you're up there, look for, you know, some of my good buddies that are up there in the instructor cadre. If you see Cav, tell him that you got Cadbury eggs, and I'm sure he'll do all sorts of things for you, helping you out with, you know, your skill set on the range and all. So guys, please check out SigSauer.com. And please check out the Sig Sauer Academy. And by the way, that is how it's pronounced, Sig Sauer. It's not Sig Sauer. And I think you're going to have a great time. Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm your host for this episode. My name is Kevin Estella. I'm here from the North Carolina office. And this might be one of the last podcasts that I do from this office, because in addition to podcasting today, I'm packing up a whole bunch of stuff. You know, Kevin Owens is the one that opened this office. I guess I'm the Kevin that's going to close it. We're still going to train in North Carolina. But the physical location, I was told from the folks out west that they're going to shut it down. So just a heads up, that's where I am right now. If you hear an echo in the background, it's because we got empty walls. Guys, on this podcast today, I've got a gentleman who has such an interesting background, and he is someone who I think you're going to enjoy hearing his story. And I'm hearing a chime in the background. I think that guy is in his car or something. But back in the day, like this is probably 2009, 2010, maybe 2011, I was really getting into, you know, pistol marksmanship and like 25 yard bull shooting and working with the guys from SIOC Tactical. And I remember being at one of the courses, and I remember having my belt all loaded out. What kind of belt was it? It was a Brokos belt. Well, the gentleman on the show today is the gentleman behind the Brokos belt. And, you know, it was interesting. We talked yesterday briefly, just prepping, or 2 days ago, briefing for this podcast. And we both agreed that we're not going to run out of content. So with that being said, I want to introduce Dan Brokos to the podcast. Dan, thank you so much for joining us. And I know you had a crazy day of travel this morning.
Oh, no. Hey, I really appreciate the invite. And it's glad to catch up with you and be on the show.
Yeah. So where exactly were you this morning? Just so the listeners have an idea, like you traveled early, right? Like 2 a.m. or something?
Yeah. I flew in late. I was out in Eagle Lake, Texas, just, I want to say, northwest of Houston, teaching a class out there. And I had a late flight in. So I'm back home in Southern Virginia now. But we had a kind of bad weather. So Wi-Fi and phone signal is kind of up in the air. So I'm sitting in my truck, which has the best internet around when you live in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, Texas has its own share of bad weather. I went out there a couple years ago to go hunting with a buddy of mine. And when I was there, I brought the cold weather from the north, because apparently San Antonio doesn't get a whole bunch of snow. But when I got there, all the ice formed on the trees. They were shutting down schools. Like it was a nightmare. And Texas is just one of those places where it's the land of extremes. Like San Antonio had ice and snow, and probably by this time it's like 110 degrees already, I'm guessing. So, how was that training class? Were you doing pistol, shotgun? What exactly were you covering?
It was a class for Beretta, which I'm fortunate enough. We signed an agreement and we work with Beretta now. And it was, I do 10 to 12 classes a year for Beretta. We travel around and train the sales team on pistol, shotgun, whatever. We change it up every year. But we just ran 2 day pistols, red dots, just get the guys comfortable with the new APX A1 and the transition that everybody's seeing, going from iron sights to red dot. And all the regional sales team guys have to be very familiar with all the products for Beretta, and they're awesome people, but I just want to make them more comfortable. So when they get all these new guns in and, you know, maybe the CEO of Shalil says, "Hey, can you come down and put my guys through the gamut at our indoor range," that they're more comfortable doing that.
Yeah. And I just want to point out that the way that we got connected was through Beretta. Beretta has been incredibly generous to our defensive shotgun program here. And when they found out that we were running pump shotguns and, you know, we weren't as familiar with the semis, they're like, "Well, we're going to send your guys shotgun." So we started using them, and now Jerry, myself, Rick Lofton, we all prefer the 1301 or the A300. There's no doubt in my mind that that is like the most impressive shotgun that's on the market right now. And you got an opinion on the 1301?
Oh, I gotta agree with you. Is you know, differences in the recoil operating system, both of them, but you can't go wrong with a Beretta 1301 or an A300. It's just the 1301's been my favorite, and it's just so fast and reliable. And the good thing is it's not finicky. You can put any type of ammo in those shotguns and they'll run all day long. Just extremely reliable and fast. But yeah, I'm glad that you guys got linked up with Beretta, especially running that shotgun program that you guys are running. Yeah, there's a time and a place for a pump shotgun, maybe breaching, but other than that, you know, semi-auto shotguns rule the world now.
Oh, no doubt about it. And what I want to do is I kind of want to let the listeners know how you were able to rise to the level and the skill set where Beretta is like, "Hey, we want to team up with you," because, you know, reading through your bio and you know, we have a a mutual friend in common with the folks over at Recoil. I read through your article over there, and I was like, damn, super impressive career. And, you know, I'm reading through like your daily carry, and, you know, I'm seeing like, oh, range 37. And I'm like, oh, that's Fort Bragg territory, you know? So you spent some time over in this area. And then I saw, something in one of your interviews, and it's like, the most beautiful ebony princess juice. And I was like, hold on, there's going to be a whole bunch of fun stuff, you know, in this conversation. And it said like, she made me write that or something. So how did you, and we'll get to all that, but how did you get to this level of skill that, that Beretta is like, Dan, we want you to join us on our pro team, teach our guys, like kind of take us from the very beginning of your firearms journey.
Well, I would say this. I think I won't say lucky, but fortunate enough to run into the right people in the right time, and know people who know friends of mine that I just feel fortunate enough and blessed to have gotten to where I've gotten. I'm not saying I haven't put in the hard work on that. Everybody puts in the hard work. It's just that it kind of started, you know, in the military as far as what my job was, and you got to be able to, you know, shoot, move, and communicate. But I fell in love with the shooting aspect of that. And, you know, we'd always bring in professional instructors out there, and we were bringing in Kyle Lamb when I was over in C-110 in Germany a couple times a year, and we sort of hit it off pretty good. And, you know, when I got back to do a tour at Range 37, when I left Germany, I started helping him out with classes, and he kind of showed me the ropes of, as far as, I'll say not teaching, but, you know, teaching at Range 37 and bringing in that and working with Kyle for a little bit really, really kicked off my interest in, hey, what is Dan going to do after he decides to hang up, you know, the big green machine and move on from life? And I really didn't know what I was going to do. And this sort of fell into my lap with, I've met through the shooting committee, Ian Harrison out at Recoil Magazine. And, you know, he sort of was like, what are you going to do? I'm like, man, I don't know. I might try to do my own thing as far as shooting wise, but who doesn't want to do that? And it just, you know, I sat down with him. He's like, hey, I'm going to do an article, and that really helped the promotion of it. And I've really gotten into cahoots with, guys from Trigicon, Safariland, that really, really helped take this career off, where I think most people start blind. I started blind, but I knew a lot of people in the industry, and I think that was a solid jump into the industry for us, compared to other people that don't have those connections.
Yeah. And you mentioned Kyle Lamb. I've met Kyle two or three times, and I'm always impressed by his memory. That guy is unbelievable when it comes to what he's able to retain, and apparently his library that he has at home is incredibly impressive. And I would be, you know, wrong if I didn't say that Kyle Lamb's son, Chris Caballero, up at the SIG Academy, you know, and that's an inside joke, but Kyle Lamb, that guy's so impressive. So, when he is kind of talking you through those things, like, what was the key takeaway that you got from Kyle to become an instructor? Like, what was it that, like, when you're looking back at him as a formative instructor, someone that you maybe like modeled yourself after, like, what was it about his teaching style that you're like, I like the way that he teaches, I might do something like that?
You know, I want to say that the military sort of teaches us to have maybe a cut and dry personality, if you want to say that, where I would say at work, I was all business. Of course, you know, you get along with the dudes and hang out afterwards, but just when he came over there, he had such a great personality. Besides learning something, we were laughing all the time. He just really, really reached people. And I go back and think the first time I came back to Bragg, and he's like, hey, you want to help me with this class? And yeah, I remember driving out to the first class with him, and he was like, all right, look, don't pound anybody into the ground. Don't punch anybody. This ain't C-110. You guys are yelling at people when they're doing things wrong. Just help me out. And I ended up, you know, taught several classes with him and watched him. And I really, you know, admired the passion he had for it, but also how he articulated and his personality. And he told me, he's like, it wasn't always like this. It's taken years to grow into that as having a personality. And it sort of was my first thing. It's like, man, this is a pretty good gig, but it goes back to, I remember a conversation, you know, you have on, I'd say on the mind, body, spiritual side is, you know, we're all in the, or should be looking for, you know, community service. How do we do service to others? And, you know, very modestly, I think that's, you know, been my calling is, hey, everything I learned in the military, let's pass on to other people. So, you know, that conversation we had in this truck in that first class was what really got me thinking. And I started really, really learning a lot from every time I shot with them.
And, you know, I think something we should talk about too is the extent of your military career, because, you know, I was reading some of the countries that you travel to in service, and, you know, a lot of people, you know, especially in this area right now, they're still very active or they recently retired. And, you know, when you look at what they've done for service, it was limited to just one region, but it seems like you bounced around to a lot of different places. Like, can you kind of give us a summary of the different places you traveled to and what you did in each?
Yeah, I think I was very fortunate enough. You throw the, you know, now there is UCOM, AFRICOM command. But back then, when I was growing up there, you know, besides deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, there was actually still some real world missions going on in the Balkans and Kosovo, as far as, you know, snatching up PIFWICs, guys that were on the list over there. And the fact that we had to cover down on UCOM and AFRICOM, I mean, those are huge places. While we weren't deployed, you know, the job was to train, advise, and teach. And, you know, the U.S. is like, hey, we got to get other countries involved in this war. So if we weren't deployed, we were off in Romania, Estonia, you name it, that country, training them up so they could deploy to these countries and help us fight the war on terrorism. So it was a good opportunity, not only, you know, not to visit that country, but we taught a lot of marksmanship to probably 20, 30, 40 countries, and, you know, to teach it, to know it, let alone the schoolhouse you show in that. I mean, if you can teach, and there's nothing wrong with it, some of these, I would say, third world countries that don't have a lot of ammo and experience, marksmanship, man, you're way better off teaching it on the end run, as far as, you know, as the end user, when it comes to actually performing those fundamentals yourself.
Out of curiosity, when you're teaching all these different people in these different countries, there's got to be a language barrier at times. Like, did you find anything very useful for teaching someone who maybe doesn't have a firm grasp of the English language?
Yes, there's a lot of, you know, there's always an interpreter, but we've always had a guy who was, be honest, fluent in that language, mm-hmm. Good enough to converse. So we would dial that in before training and said, hey, who speaks English? Okay, you are going to translate to the dude. So yeah, that was, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a challenge in itself is, you know, you can't go on to this huge pontification about the eight fundamentals for 45 minutes and have an interpreter or expect these guys who have a grasp of the language to pick it up, because it's not going to happen. There was a lot of, I would say, pointy talky where, hey, here's a fundamental, we're going to shoot, this is what we're looking for. So you really, really have to break it down to the basic level and not tap dance around the subject. And it really helped the dudes in the long run, not just, you know, the American SF guys teaching it, but those guys by breaking it down by the numbers. But yeah, it's one of those aspects people don't realize. And I, like I said, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was always a learning point before we went and out and taught marksmanship to another country. It's like, all right, hey guys, we got to break this down very, very slow, because remember, there's an interpreter in a language barrier gap. So we can't be, you know, given 45 minute PowerPoints on the eight fundamentals of marksmanship, because that's going to go one ear and out the other. It's talk about a fundamental, shoot it, explain it. A lot of, hey, here's my finger, here's where it goes on the trigger. So it took longer, the first couple of days, but once you got that through, it was back to business.
You know, I'm curious even further now, like, my late mentor, Marty, was an Army survival instructor. He was an infantry guy in Vietnam, and he experienced a lot of different cultures in his military career and a lot of people from different cultures. But he said that the group that impressed him the most physically, like pound for pound, the strongest people he has ever seen were the Montagnards from Vietnam. I'm just curious if there is a group that when you train them as students, you're like, damn, these people are really good with shooting, like, or they're really good with field craft, and they're really good with, you know, understanding what it takes to operate. You know, like, was there one group that really stood out where you were like, wow, these guys, they're dialed in?
To throw out like the Polish Grom and the British SAS, those guys have always stood on their own 2 feet, and there's a lot of units like that. If I could go down to the smaller countries that were just standing up trying to get in, I'll be honest, it was probably the Romanians in the department we worked with down there, because those guys bought in big to Afghanistan, and they spent a lot of money on the right equipment and proper equipment. When we first showed up, you know, they had UMP-40s, and I'm like, that's probably not the preferred assault rifle to do things with. And, you know, through the State Department and out of my hands, but next thing you know, we got M4s and the right weapons, the right optics, and those guys really took it serious. And, I can't recall, but we were probably down there 6, 7, 8 times training with the one unit that eventually, you know, worked the way in Afghanistan for several years.
Yeah. Damn. Yeah. I've heard things about the Romanians. I'm half Polish, and I can tell you that, you know, the work ethic is definitely there in the Polish genes. So, I'll just say that every Polish guy I know is a hard worker. I've never met a lazy Polish dude. And then the British SES, I mean, that goes without saying.
Yeah, there's a lot of good out there. I would say this, everybody we work with wanted to be there, you know, wanted to help. And I think I individualized them out because I was just there so many times, and we actually ran into them in Afghanistan, which is like the full 360 circle of train, advise, and assist. And then next year, you know, you're at war with them.
No kidding. So, we don't need to go into all the specifics, but when you say you ran into them, was that just on like a base out there? Was it literally bumping into them into the field? Like, what was, do you recall any experiences where you came in contact with them?
It was, so at that time that they're over there, I mean, I was at company sergeant major level. So we had some of the teams and troops throughout, and they actually had like their own AOR in Afghanistan, and one of the guys operated in there, and I remember talking to them, not me personally, but the guys did, is like, hey, Dan, those are the guys that we were working with the last 6 or 7 times. I'm like, man, no shit, small world, we finally ran into them. How are they doing? They said they're doing great,
man. And so you spent 20 was it 26 or 27 years in the Army?
I say 27, it was 26 years and 10 months to be exact.
Okay. The last, let's say like the last couple of years of your time in the Army was devoted to training here regionally, I'm assuming. And I'm trying to recall who I bumped into recently at range, who said that they worked at range 37, or they, you know, they used to work at range 37. But that range is legendary. Now, being a civilian, I'm never going to go to range 37, but I've heard so many things about like the level of training there. And I think a whole documentary could probably be done on range 37. So in your last few years of military service at range 37, can you kind of describe the, not like the tempo of it, but like, what was the feel at that range? Like, what's the mission of that range? What's like the goal of the instructors that are there?
So that's probably, I would say, in my opinion, the best place to work if you're going to take an operational break and pass on skills to other Green Berets, Rangers, and everybody else who goes through that course. I say that, but also most guys are, you know, at the time when I was in, it was, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq are in full bore, and they're doing a deployment a year, coming back, doing other things. And, you know, nobody wants to go and do their SWCC tour, but when you go, you know, everybody works hard, don't get me wrong, but that place works extremely hard, and there's not a lot of time off. Don't think you're gonna go to range 37 and finish up your college degree or be home at 3 o'clock visiting a wife and kids. But everybody wants to come out there. So really the job for that is there's two different sides to range 37, and it's, you have the CIFSIC, Special Forces Sniper Course, it used to be called SODIC, where, you know, all the detachments and all the other units out there that desire to be a Cat 1 sniper go through that course. And, you know, it's changed over the years. It used to be 6 courses. Now we're running 4 courses a year with like a 3-week gap in between them. And then you have the other side, which was, you know, and we're talking CIFSIC. It's just not long range shooting. It's comms, field craft, the whole gamut of what it takes to be a sniper. Then on the other side, you know, the Sephardic side, which was stood up to support the CRFs or old school CIFs. Their name has changed a couple times, and those guys are geographically located to be a crisis response for, you know, I worked for the UCOM commander, and we had the UCOM and AFRICOM AOR, and your job was, you needed that skill set to make you a tier 2 operator, and that was advanced marksmanship, CQB, breaching, vehicle interdiction, the whole gamut that comes with that. And, you know, both of them are, it goes back and forth, 8-9 week courses, and you're really working your ass off. And there's a lot of nights, days and nights for the students and instructors in that course, but it's a great course. I want to say, you know, we're firing a couple million rounds.
Damn.
A year in that course. I mean, it's full bore of marksmanship on both sides of the committee.
Something that I always like talking about are like the standards, you know, because I think it's real easy to say, hey, you did a good job. You know, that's like a half-ass compliment. Like, hey, good job. Well, why is it good? You know, how is it good compared to other shooters? I think it's so important to track data and follow standards and say, like, look, you shot really well because here's the standard, here's the average, and you're shooting 10% better than the average, you know, that type of thing. So with an 8-week long course, I mean, what are some of the standards, so to speak, that, you know, students are expected to live up to? Like, you know, obviously if you're on time, you're late, right? You know, was there anything that was like instant recycle back to the beginning of the 8-week course? Was there anything like that would surprise us as listeners, as people that are hearing?
No,
about?
Not really. No? They all had their, both sides of the committee had their gates as far as an eval, where it would be like, all right, hey, you know, we have 4 to 6 critical CTEs. The assaulters would shoot in a stress test. Those were must pass events in order to move on to CQB. Then you got into CQB, and it was, I want to say, 4 or 5 CQB tests. And, you know, here's the bottom line is you take the eval sheet, and, you know, you had one instructor per student watching them and grading them, and you want everybody to pass because you're like, man, that's a good dude. I'm going to try to get him over to C110. Well, hey, at the end of the day, if he doesn't make the cut, he doesn't make the cut, and it's walking. The attrition rate is rather high on both sides of that course, and on the sniper side of the coin, you got the same thing. You know, you got stocky values you must pass, and you have probably, and it's been a while since I've been there, 4 or 5 sniper marksmanship evaluations that are must pass. There's no, hey, you didn't miss the mark. So it's, if you don't pay attention in training, and I tell you, the guys that are having problems, they stay after, they work long hours with them. of course, there's a pre-shoot and a test. And the biggest thing about the sniper side is, you know, it's you and your buddy. So you got to get along with your buddy good when it comes down to the grading system. But at the end of the day, there's no recycle back to day one. It's like, hey, you didn't pass. Great job. You're a good dude. Come back next class if your unit lets you.
Gotcha. Okay. And then as far as physical fitness, yesterday when I was talking to JJ Ricasa on the podcast, JJ is a physical specimen in of himself. Like, he's looking to squeeze, you know, an extra ounce of or extra percentage out of his capability. I mean, with all these, like, the latest and greatest methods of training. But JJ was very complimentary of you. He's like, Dan's a beast. So I'm curious, because I know you're 6'3", I think you're rating like 275, big dude. What kind of physical training was required to be successful out there? And what's your current physical training routine?
I tell you, so we did everything the wrong way. And I would, people ask me, hey, what's one of the biggest changes you've seen in the special forces community? And it was the induction of what we called the Thor program, which was, you know, before Thor came about, and this is not just for the Army, but this is the SEALs, the Marines, the Air Force, everybody under the USASOC umbrella, you know, we all used the post gym, and we were just pretty much cut to your own pace of like, mm-hmm. Hey, do what you think needs to be done to pass. And at the end of the day, it's very physically demanding being in the special operations community. But you never had any professional classes. And I think 2007, 2008, this came on board, and, you know, we got our own gyms, clamshells built behind where we work. And you had two or three strength and conditioning coaches, a physical therapist, a nutritionist, all the chow halls got supplementation, and the food and nutrition was dialed in for us. And we were actually taught how to train. And I remember the first conversation we had, Patrick Borkowski was my first strength and conditioning coach. And he's like, you guys are doing way too much, man. You're getting injuries. You're running and rucking every day, too long, too far. And I'm like, all right, explain this to me. And, you know, all these strength and conditioning coaches came from collegiate professional programs. He goes, all right, hey, Dan, I want to have this guy run 2 miles. All right, it took him 13 minutes and 30 seconds. Heart rate monitor on, all this. His heart, I don't know, came down immediately after like 6 minutes after the run. And the other dude did 300 wall balls. And he goes, all right, his heart rate's still up. He burnt more calories, and he worked shoulders, legs, and everything. But his heart rate was just as high as the guy running. It's like, your heart doesn't know you're running. Your heart just knows it's outputting. So you guys are wearing the shit out of your backs and knees. Not to say we didn't run, but they taught us how to train properly. And, you know, it was all functional fitness. It went away from who gives a shit how much you can bench press. Not saying it's not a good exercise, but it turned into functional. And really, the mobility and agility portion of that, which prevents you to get injuries, because there were some guys that, man, when I first started there, I couldn't do any of the Olympic lifting until my mobility got correct. And now it's one of my favorite things to do. But I still take that mobility, agility, functional fitness aspect to me. I think it keeps you younger. You know, mind, body, spirit is my motto. I try to hit it 6 times a week, and it just keeps you healthy, because traveling as much as I do teaching, I really, really can't afford a major injury. And they taught us a lot about overtraining, which we all were overtraining, which caused the injuries. And, you know, you kind of got to dial yourself in before 4 or 6 month deployment to be at the top of your food game. Be at the top of the food chain. And that is in, you know, mind, body, spirit. And that's the three things they taught, not just physical wise, but nutrition wise, and spiritual wise, you know, the mental agility it takes to succeed, in all aspects is what they brought to the plate.
We got to stay on this topic, because I'm taking notes here, not just for, you know, the show description, but my own notes. And, you know, I think you hit the nail on the head when you're saying that, like, you know, the the focus had to change. You know, talking to a number of the guys around this community, they said, you know, early pre 9/11, everyone was bench pressing. They were looking like Arnold Schwarzenegger in Commando.
Yes.
Right. And then you talk to these guys and they're like, yeah, you watch those guys get off of the protein and get more cardio. And they leaned because they were like, when they were moving from rooftop to rooftop, it made more sense to jump 180 pound body from one gap to another instead of a 230, 240. And I was like, that makes total sense. And, you know, I think like by the time this podcast comes out, I'm going to be turning 44, you know, even looking back at my like athletic career, so to speak, me training and being in shape. I remember early 20s, it was like, get as big as you possibly can, bench as much as you can. Then you train jiu-jitsu and you find out your opponent is never going to be equal weight on both sides. Why don't you start doing some offset stuff and more functional fitness, right? And like you said, you have to take care of your body, because if you're on the road constantly, like we are here with travel, well, I can't train as well or as efficiently if I have to wear a knee brace. So like, I'm curious, because, you know, you've been in this game for a while. What do you feel are some of the red flags that people should be aware of? Like, hey, I've been training. It's like, okay, but you're doing this, red flag. Like, are there any red flags for a guy that's, say, like middle age, or maybe if we were to take this question back a second, red flags in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, like, what would you say? Stop doing that, start doing this. Like, what would those be for those different age ranges, 20, 30, 40 on?
And, you know, everybody has their own opinion, and I am no expert at anything when it comes to the physical and nutrition side, but I was taught a lot of things and I try to follow this. But the point you brought up is, back when I was young, it was like, man, you know, everybody thought the way you looked was physical fitness. But once you start moving 10 clicks over mountaintops to hit a village in Afghanistan, there's no, you know, jackass assault where you can just ride up, one carrying kit, machine guns, and a bunch of ammo. You're going to be like, cardio is probably king when it comes down to that. And you brought that point up, but I think you get away with a lot in your 20s and 30s. But you know, once you start getting older, you got to realize that, man, you know, looks ain't everything. You know, some of the red flags, if you're tired all the time, or if you're constantly aching your joints and all that stuff, you should probably check your nutrition. You really, really should, as far as that comes, because I got into this whole foods concept is, man, if there's any processed ingredients in it, I'm not putting it in my body. It's just not going. And I don't get sick a lot. I get my blood tested, probably, you know, there's a lot of biomarkers to say, hey man, how's your inflammation? How's your, you know, your fasting glucose levels, and all that comes back to nutrition first before you do anything.
Yeah. You know, you can't have a Ferrari, or what you might view as a Ferrari, and feed it 87 octane. You know, you got to put better nutrition in there. But I mean, I know plenty of guys that are like, well, that food's really expensive. But then you look at their habits, and their habits are going out having expensive drinks at bars with their friends, or their habits are going to the range, shooting long range. And it's like, you'll feed your rifle a round that costs $1.75 every shot, but you won't invest in what you're feeding yourself, you know? And that nutrition thing, I've got a buddy who did the whole foods thing, and he basically said the easiest way to remember what to eat and what not to eat: every bit of food in my body has one ingredient. It's like broccoli is broccoli. It's not broccoli covered with batter and deep fried and peanut oil. It's broccoli. And it's like, if you can do that, if you start off with like half of your diet and you say, I'm just going to eat whole foods for half of it, you're already better than you were if you were like, well, let's just stop at the local supermarket, grab a whole bunch of chicken tenders and mozzarella stick. Like, at some point it will catch up to you, internally or externally. Like, you could look really fine, but internally you might be a train wreck, you know, with high cholesterol and blood pressure and whatnot. You know, it is what it is.
I totally agree with you. And, you know, these are all things that were taught to me, you know, when, like I said, the SF side, I call it the Thor program, or everybody, every tier unit has something different with it, but you know, when I moved up in the ranks into my mid 30s and 40s, you know, you gotta try to keep up with all these young dudes that are coming in 28, 25, 26. And, you know, you can throw anything in your, down your neck and eat it and still perform. But I think the older you get, the more you got to be self-conscious about overtraining and nutrition really comes. And, you know, I didn't blow the nutritionist off at the time, but I'm like, yeah, man, I'm good. I'm in shape. Here's my times. I'm in the top 10, 20 percentile. I'm good. But the older I got is always in the back of my mind. And like anything else, you know, I'm not afraid to say, hey, I don't know everything. And, you know, picking up a book every now and then and reading it, you don't have to agree with it. Like the last book I read was How Not to Die. It was a guy who says meat is horrible for you. Eggs are horrible for you. You should only eat vegetables and fruits if you want to live longer. I don't agree with him, but he's got some valid points about different types of vegetables and fruits and what they do for you. And that's why I read the book. I mean, I still eat dairy and meat, raw dairy. But you know, all this stuff was passed on to me, through that program. And I just continue to preach and push for myself to, you know, what I was taught in SF. And I feel fortunate enough that program came along, because we'd still be rucking 50 miles a week and running every day, and people are blown out their knees and wonder why they're getting injured. You know, you don't want to be the guy pulling an ACL downrange walking through the mountaintop, because then you're out of the fight, and that just sucks.
Yeah. You know, to your point about all these different opinions, I think you look back through the history of like Food and Drug Administration, you look at the history of, you know, all the, like the American Medical Association, and you look at what they recommend. Well, for part of that time, they would say, don't drink alcohol, but then suddenly, well, wine is okay. And then don't drink sugar or don't eat sugar. It's bad for you. And then it's don't have oil in your diet. Don't have high fat in your diet. And everything changes. Like I just saw something that it said, if you feed your kid an egg a day for their first couple of years of, or not first couple of years, for like the first years of like their childhood, so outside of infancy, they're like, they will statistically score 15% higher on tests. And it's like, there's an importance to animal protein. And it's like, okay, that's an interesting study, and I'll read into it the same way. And like you said, that it speaks to a larger issue when people are so quick to say, well, I don't agree with that. It's gotta be wrong. It's like, just because you don't agree with something doesn't mean that you're right. You know, you gotta, you know, take all these different opinions for what they are. I kind of want to talk about, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I kind of want to shift into lead faucet, because through your private training, it led to all those things I mentioned at the very beginning of the podcast, the Broco's belt, and now the partnership with Beretta. Can you kind of talk through the transition and the decision-making process of going from career in the military to private sector?
Yes. So when I got out, I kind of like the year before, I was probably going to go, I don't know. I didn't know what I was going to do. And then I'm like, man, I'm just going to give this a whirl, because it's something I always liked doing. And I said, hey, worst case, you know, we live where I can live off my retirement. And if it doesn't pan out, it doesn't pan out. And I'll find a job, but it's something that I always wanted to do. And my wife was super supportive of it. And she's like, hey, if that's what you want to do, I'll drop my job and I'll help you out. I mean, you know, she built the entire website. You know, we saved some money up the last year and a half before I retired and dropped it on products. And it took a while to, you know, to approach people to do the products and all that stuff. And, you know, we just worked at it day and day, the daily grind of starting your own business. And people ask me, oh, man, it must be easy. I'm like, no, it's not. It's, I think I'd rather be deployed at a leadership level, controlling six layers of ISR and everything else on target, than running my own business. I really would. And anybody in the small business community can tell you. And I listen to, and I'm not comparing myself to these guys because we're small. We're fortunate enough now to have, you know, we actually have three other employees, a couple guys that work for us. And it's relatively small, but it's still challenging. But I listened to a podcast. I forget his name. I think Evan Tanner on Black Rifle Coffee mm-hmm. Company. And he's like, it's the hardest thing we've ever done in our entire lives is stand up a business. And those guys are gigantic compared to me. But I get to what he was saying. It really is. And here's the thing, though. And you just can't work 9 to 5 because I'm riding my whole family's future on this thing. Right. So you really get up early and go to bed late.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to point something out, too. I think you're a great example of what a good family man should be in that. You know, prior to this podcast, I'm doing all the research on you. So I know what we should cover. And it's very clear that you're proud of your family. You're proud of like the happiness that you guys have. And like, you guys look genuinely happy. And, you know, I got to say, you know, I was joking around earlier. You know, I was messaging you and I was messaging Amanda, you know, from Beretta, and, you know, your wife was on the email too. And I saw the signature, but I didn't know it was a signature at the time. I saw it was Juice. And I'm like, what is Juice? I was like, is that like the new thing kids are saying these days? Like, you know, like, bet, you know, and like, I was like, what is it? Like, I didn't know. And then I didn't realize that was short for her name. But you guys, like, you're always quick to give her the praise that she deserves. And that's admirable because I think sadly there are so many guys out there that are like, well, I don't want to talk about my wife. You know, it's my decision. It's like, no, you're in a relationship, dude. Like that's a very important thing that you guys are 50-50 or, you know, like you're making these decisions together. So I think it's just really cool that you guys are, you know, an understanding like that. So without going into too many details, unless you want to, can you kind of give a little praise to her? Like, how did you guys meet? Like, how did you guys, like, what is it that makes you guys click so well? Because there are guys that are probably listening right now, sitting at home all single, being like, I need to find a woman. So what's the Dan Brokos dating advice to find a good mate for the rest of your life?
Here, I'll shoot you straight one. I'll tell you, we met at a CrossFit gym.
Okay.
Up in Raleigh. She's working out of the gym, and a buddy of mine owned another gym, and this is years ago, and they team up and have these like local meets against each other. And I remember going out, and we all went down to this, I forget the name of the local pub in the town it was after. That's where I initially met her. But the first time I brought her into work, you know, she was like, well, is everybody, is that his real name? I'm like, no, half of the guys got nicknames like Meathead, you know, and she's like, oh, what would my nickname be? I'm like, don't say that right now. And everybody just like paused. I'm like, don't worry about it, guys. She's never been around the military, especially SF guys before. Don't give her a nickname. Just like, don't open that can of worms in his office right now. And she's like, no, what would my nickname be? I said, Juice. She's like, why? I'm like, I don't know. You just look juicy, right? And it's funny to say that. She goes, we've been dating about a month. And she goes, you talked to your mom? I said, I talked to your mom one time. She goes, you know, Juice has been my nickname since I was 2 years old.
Get out of here.
I said, really? She's like, yep. So it was a small world. I guessed her nickname. That's the nickname I gave her. But she's been calling that since, you know, she was 2 years old with that. But yeah, no, she really... My dating advice is this, is she calls me out on bullshit.
Awesome.
And no other woman has. And at first I was like, man, who you, what are you crazy? But at the end of the day, you know, she's like, man, I'm your biggest cheerleader, but I'm also your biggest support asset. And, you know, if you fuck up, I'm going to tell you, and you need to do the same to me. And I said, man, this is, you know, it didn't take a while, but I just never had that from a woman before saying, hey, you're fucked up. And you're dead wrong on that. You got to be a better man to do that. Like, you know, she references the Bob a lot. And she's like, you know, losing your temper is not a sign of maturity. Like all these little things when we first met, and I'm just like, man, she's onto something. So yeah. I really give her credit for, I'll be honestly changing me.
Yeah. You know, and I think that's so important. people aren't good when it comes to receiving criticism because they take it as a personal attack. But the criticism, if it's from someone who loves you, it's to make you a better person, and it's done out of love. And it's like, look, you know, don't bark at them. If anyone, like, look at yourself and why you're getting angry. It's there's probably an ounce of truth to it. And I find that, you know, so many issues come up when people can't accept criticism instead of just saying thank you and I will address it, and then checking up on that person again and seeing if they actually did. So shout out to Juice. thanks for,
thank you.
Thanks for making Dan a good dude. And, thanks for double checking that our schedules were lined up for this morning. So she's been working with you with the business and Lead Faucet Tactical. I read up on, you know, the name, and, you know, and I know that it comes from like setting or open up the lead faucet, you know, like more rounds on range as opposed to just single shots and whatnot.
Yep.
Your company, can you describe what kind of courses you're offering outside of Beretta? Like, I know pistol, shotgun, carbine. Is there anything else that you guys are doing?
We're besides like, I really got big besides, you know, we offer a 2 or 3 day pistol, 2 or 3 day carbine, you know, a 2 or 3 day, you know, cause it all depends on the client, urban gunfighter, which is really fighting in and around cover and positions of cover, whether it's barricades, replicate a wall and vehicles. But also what's really grown for us is teaching CQB, and really another CQB marksmanship course has spawned off of that one. So those are probably our two biggest go-to classes right now. And that's primarily what we teach is marksmanship and CQB tactics. Just based on my experience of, you know, what I did in the military and working at Range 37, you know, at first I was kind of like skeptical, hey, and I really don't want to bite off this can of worms, but I got asked to do a 1 day class down in Texas about 7 years ago, and the dudes really dug it and went off well. And I decided like, hey man, you know, it's, yeah, I know there's some sensitive stuff in there, but you're passing it off to Ellie guys. I mean, this could potentially save their life. And it's really gratifying to hear some of the, you know, TTPs that I learned in the military and that, you know, law enforcement's using and they're enjoying it and it's working for them. And we do have some products as well, carbine, pistol accessories, slings, dump pouches. And that's been our focus this year. Been running so hard on classes that we kind of forgot about products, but we went back and rewrote the business plan and we're going to focus on products, this year. And of course, Beretta classes as well and supporting, you know, the oldest and best gun company in the world.
two follow-ups. What drives me crazy sometimes is when a company develops products, but they don't get input from trainers. And it seems like Lead Faucet kind of leads the way with, you know, the products that are coming out, like what the instructors are saying, man, it would be great if we had XYZ. So the first question I have regarding product, is what is it like, what are some of the new products that have kind of come out that are changing the way that you're training? Like, is there something that you would consider a game changer across the board, whether it's your product or something that just kind of emerged as a technology in the training space? Is there something that you're seeing now that is changing the way that people train?
Man, that's a tough question because I think products go in waves of like every 5 years, you got to sort of reinvent the wheel. And if you're not out in 5 years, you're kind of behind the power curve. But you know, lately it seems minuscule, but you know, every rail's M-lock, every accessory needs to be tight to the rail, things like that. Smaller and lighter nowadays, believe it or not. I think that's the biggest change I've seen. And I go back to, you know, being bundled up in kit when we first started deploying to what we're running around in now. And then I also correlate it a lot to the LE because those are probably my biggest clients, is smaller and lighter compared to buttoned up. And that goes from kit down to guns. I really think the application of a red dot on a pistol is probably the biggest game changer that I've seen, in the training aspect. And I remember when I, you know, first started teaching with Kyle years ago, we worked with the DEA and they came on out and had iron sights on their carbines. And I was like, dude, you guys don't have aim points? Yeah, we don't use them. They're in the locker. And he's like, well, we're not starting right now. Drive back to your place. Wow. Get all those aim points because we're putting them on. And they're old school. No, Kyle, dude. We shoot way better with iron sights. He's like, go get the fucking aim points before we start.
Wow.
And they went and drive and got the aim points. And I tell you what, they were like, holy shit. We've had these for 3 years, and he's like, I told you guys, and we ran them for a week with those guys, and they love them. And I see that now. I'd say 6 years ago, I'd show up for a pistol class, and I would see three red dots and the rest iron sights. Now it's the other way around. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad because my eyes kind of go and, I see that red dot well better. In my last class, me and a buddy of mine, Jared Reston, he does the same job as me. He's a retired SWAT guy. And we had 24 dudes. There was one dude with iron sights, and he was running a single stack 9/11 too. And I'm like, old school right there. I was calling him Longmire. I'm like, Longmire, you haven't caught on yet? He's like, nope, never going to, Dan. I said, man, let me tell you the story about aim points. And I told him that same exact story. And I said, man, we should be running them, fellas, in a nutshell. So I know that was a lot of talking, but I would say the application of red dots on pistols is a game changer that I've seen the evolution of over the last 3-4 years.
Outstanding. Now, the second question actually comes from someone who I posted up online. I was like, hey, I'm going to be podcasting JJ Ricasa and Dan Brokos. And I said, does anyone have any questions? And I got a response from a guy who doesn't want to be, recognized, but he said, I am new to firearms. I don't have anything. What order should I get? XYZ, basically, like in a nutshell, I'm summarizing it, like pistol, shotgun, what would be your order first and why?
If he's brand new and I know, there's a 2.8 million new gun owners since COVID, because everybody thought the world was going to come to an end. I would definitely start off with a pistol with iron sights. I'm pro that. And then learn the fundamentals and then hop on with the red dot. And I encourage yourself, and a lot of problem with that is really stepping out of your comfort zone and saying, hey, you know what? I don't know what I'm doing, but I need to take a class. Because at the end of the day, I get these stats from Recoil when I was on a podcast during COVID, and there was 2.3 million gun owners. And then the follow-up question was like, well, out of those 2.3 million, we were all asked, what's realistically, how many do you think are confident enough to carry that around and actually pull out and use it? And I'd say probably less than 5%. Mm-hmm. I really would. And every time I teach a class that with new gun owners, I'm like, hey, before this class, do you have the confidence ever pulled out? No, I did not. And I just think if you're going to carry, you better have the confidence to pull out and use it, especially if you have to defend your family or anything like that. So I would start with a pistol and then probably work my way to a shotgun and then a carbine, because, man, I love a shotgun for home defense and everything else. It's very easy. Juice can shoot very well. God forbid anybody tries to break into to the farm. She's got a Beretta 1301 sitting next to the bed. You can't really mess with that thing.
So something that I'm just curious about is COVID happened 3 years ago now, 3-4 years ago. And at that time, like you said, so many new gun owners, and people thought it was going to be the end of the world. People thought that, it was going to be way worse than it actually was. We've got 2024, that's still the majority of it is ahead of us. And, the election at the end of the year, which I think is going to be, oh, we just lost Dan. I'm going to try him back, guys. Stand by. I'm just going to put a show note in here. 54 minutes. Hey, Dan, sorry about that. I don't know.
No, that was me, bro. I knew my signal dropped, dude. And I was talking for probably 5 minutes before I even realized it. Where did we leave off?
I was in the middle of asking that last question. So we're good. I put a show note in here at 54 minutes for the editor to just splice it in. So I'll just start over that question. We'll go through it. And we're only about 5 minutes away from being done anyway. So,
okay.
All right. So 3, two, one. So something I'm just curious about is 2024 is not behind us yet. We have more of it ahead of us than we have behind us. And we know that during COVID, the United States changed. A lot of new brand new gun owners. There was panic buying and whatnot. Well, with 2024 still being so young, and we know that at the end of the year we're going to have the election coming up, which is going to be good or bad depending on which side of the aisle you're on. But overall, we're going to say it's going to cause chaos. What do you think right now is the greatest threat in this country? Like, what is something that we should all be aware of and take note of, and maybe some corrective steps to address it?
Wow, man, that's a good one. The greatest threat in this country. I'd say it's twofold. One, if I'd say the greatest threat is, I think the media and it's all propaganda. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think the media is probably one of our biggest threat. They're always trying to cause divide. You know, me personally, why don't we think of ourselves as Americans and I'll be honest, put this country first than worrying about political divisions and race and all mm-hmm. that stuff. I really think that's all propaganda. It really is. You know, you get down to individuals and all that stuff, and it's. I think the media highlights the extreme 1% on either side, and don't fall into that. I really do. I think that's a threat to just our society as a whole, is following the media around. I'm not saying don't watch the news, but man, for the most part, everybody's a good human being. There's the far left and right 1% that ruin it for everybody else. Then also, as far as like the national security threat, I really think it's the border. You know, there's only going to be a time and place where people want to do damage to the United States. There's all kinds of organizations that want to do damage. And, you know, to do that, you got to get inside the country. And it's just porous. And you're lying if they're not utilizing the porous border to get into this country and establish networks. It's happening. I know it's happening.
Yeah, sadly, we had Dr. Jason Piccolo on the show a few months back, and he's retired from working on the border. And, you know, he was a whistleblower. And he said, you know, just how many people are coming across and what, here's the other part of your threat, what the media is actually telling people versus what the reality is, you know. And I think it's working hand in hand there. You know, and it's, I think you're spot on with that one. You know, I've had people say, well, what do you think about this one or that one? I'm like, look, again, I'll have a discussion with them. I don't need to hate them. I'm not a believer in cancel culture one way or another. I don't like the idea of censorship. I think we are very, very easily manipulated at this point through our phones. And I think you're spot on. Like, watch the news, but don't be lured in by the news because they're trying to get ratings. And, you know, we talked about the guys from Recoil. Big Red, Patrick McCarthy posted something just the other day online and he calls it rage farming. And I was like, that is so brilliant. It's like, look at the people that are trying to build rage because they want you to click. They want you to comment. Don't buy into that manipulation, right? Don't buy into that clickbait and whatnot. Yeah. And if you know that that's a tactic that's being used against you, then you'll be able to adjust before, you know, before it affects you too much. So before we sign off, because I know you're busy and you just got home and I'm sure you got to do a whole bunch of stuff around the farm. And by the way, the last 5 minutes since we accidentally got cut off, and our editors will make it sound like we didn't get cut off, there's like these little birdies in the background. So even when you're talking about the biggest threat in the world, it's kind of poetic that there's these little birds that are chirping in the background. It's kind of funny in a way.
They're sitting right outside on this bush, like 12 of them, just watching me.
So before we sign off, JJ Ricasa had a message for you. I asked him, I said, you know, is there anything you want me to tell Dan Brokos? And I was told, quote unquote, he will kick his ass in go-kart. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, that's a funny story. So before SHOT Show, we all got all the ambassadors from Beretta. We had a thing, and we were going to go race go-karts, and there's a lot of shit talking, but it started raining. So the go-kart track owner wouldn't let us turn laps on that thing. But it was ongoing shit talking. We're like, no guns in our hands. This is racing time. And there is a retired NASCAR driver that is an ambassador for Beretta. And he used to race with Dale Earnhardt and everything. And Ward Burton, and he is quite the character with his Southern draw. He's right up here. I think he's in Southern Virginia. He's not too far from me. We hit it off pretty good, and we maintained contact. And I'm like, Ward, you're lucky it was raining. I was about to put you in the wall. And he just started going off. He's like, y'all never would have caught me. Never would have seen the back of my go-kart. So there's a lot of good shit talking. No, JJ's an awesome dude. And, self-learning. I'm hopping into one of his classes this year, so I'm really looking forward into it.
Yeah, where can people find you aside from JJ's class? Like, if they want to take one of your courses, if they want to, you know, support your business, if they want to, you know, see you out there and follow you online, where can they do all that?
They can find us at on Instagram, Led Fawcett Tactical. Also, LedFawcettTactical.com is our website, and it has all of our products and every class for this year that we're going to go teach on. And you can sign up for the classes on the website. And there's also info thing. You got any questions, send it to Led Fawcett Tactical, and Juice does a great job of deciphering everything. And she goes, answer these 10 emails before you leave the house today. So we will get a response, and she is awesome on customer service. And that's any questions. I get a lot of questions about tactics, shooting, what gun should I build, all the time. So feel free to shoot anything on the website info, and we'll respond, and check out our classes.
Awesome. Well, Dan, I appreciate you so much. And I appreciate Amanda from Beretta for setting this one up. And, you know, I hope you have an awesome weekend. And, you know, I know it's not Easter yet, but happy Easter a week early. Go out there and have some fun with the family. And hopefully we'll catch up at some point at one of these events.
Thank you. I appreciate you having on me and for the invite, man. Very easy going. It was great. Anytime. And I look forward to catching up with you.
You got it. And guys, if you're listening, thank you so much. This has been the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. Until next time.